The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program, WMKV, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or staff and management. The information and advice presented are educational in nature and not intended to be taken as specific legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Always consult with your own legal, accounting, or other professional before making any investment. Welcome to Real Life Real Estate Investing, a show to help you gain financial freedom by investing in real estate. Brought to you by the Real Estate Investors Association of Cincinnati and the Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing on WMKV, WLHS, and the Maple Knoll Radio Network. And now your host, Vina Jones Cox.
Good afternoon. I am Vina Jones Cox, and this is Real Life Real Estate Investing. Where every week of every year for more decades than I care to admit to, we've been bringing you the information and inspiration you need to start or grow your own real estate investing business. And today I have a guest who has sort of traditionally been the first guest of the year for several years here on Real Life Real Estate Investing, Mr. Rick Sharga. And if you're saying, I've heard that name somewhere and I don't think it was on Real Life Real Estate, that's because he is the founder and CEO of CJ Patrick Company. He's been doing market intelligence and advisory for real estate and financial companies for many, many years. You've seen him quoted 1,000 times in articles from back in the days when he was the vice president of market intelligence for Adam Data, and he was in the senior leadership at Realty Track there for a while, and auction.com. So yeah, you know his name. He's been watching data for people much, much bigger than us for many, many years, and he is joining us by phone today. Rick, welcome to Real Life Real Estate.
Thank you. It's great, great to be back. Even though you're making me sound really, really old.
Well, you know, I've seen your picture, and it looks like you must have gotten started about the time you were 10, based on your picture. But I'm just assuming you were a child prodigy. So
must be it.
We had this whole plan on all these, you know, questions we were going to talk about, and then something happened today. Between the time we talked about, hey, what about these questions, and the show actually starting, and I think it's an elephant in the room that we probably need to talk about here at the beginning of the show, and that is President Trump's announcement this afternoon that he was going to create an executive order disallowing ownership of single family homes. And it was a little unclear, do the big private equity companies, do they have to sell what they already have, or are they just not allowed to buy anything else? You know, none of that's really super clear right now, but it is all anybody is talking about in the real estate investing world today. I've been asked about it 5 times already.
It's all over social media, and I've been getting calls from the press, and it's a mess. And all we really have to go on right now is the social media post.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, it was sort of lacking in detail, but the way I read it, it looks like he's planning to cap investor purchase activity at the levels that they currently have. Mm-hmm. And ban institutions from buying more properties.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't really say what constitutes an institution, how many properties the limit will be, or anything like that. But beyond all of that, it's just a bad idea in general, and a policy aimed at the wrong place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so Rick, we're having a little bit of trouble hearing you. Are you on a headset or a speakerphone or anything like that?
No, and I'm hearing a bit of an echo on my end as well.
Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We are going to go to break. Oh, wait, George thinks that might have fixed it.
Okay.
Talk again.
Is this any better?
Oh my gosh. Oh, much what better. Button did you push? Like, we need to label that button. Fix people's voices. So whatever that button was. Yes, you sound much, much better, Rick.
Good.
Yeah, because the reasoning in the social media post was it was going to help housing affordability. And I think you and I both agree that nothing you do to the hedge funds at this moment is going to do anything about housing affordability.
Well, let's call them hedge funds just for the sake of argument, and let's just use some data, which, you know, you and I both like to look at because it takes a lot of the opinion out of the equation. The biggest of those funds, the ones that own 1,000 or more properties, collectively own about 2% of all investor-owned homes in the United States. There's about between 15 and 16 million investor-owned properties, and of those, about 2% are owned by those big institutions. That really works out, if you want to get more data detailed, to about 0.4% of all single-family homes in the country. So even if you were to force all of those investors to put those properties back into the market and try and sell them, you're only talking about 0.4% of the inventory of homes that we have across the country. And that by itself isn't enough to move the needle on the inventory shortage that we've had for a number of years now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the other things that I've kind of pay attention to what the private equity, Wall Street, hedge funds, whatever you want to call them, the REITs, the people, mm-hmm. the people who own lots and lots and lots of properties. I kind of pay attention to what they're doing because I think it's informative to what the rest of us should be doing. when they're sitting on dry powder, I start thinking, well, maybe they're seeing some bargains coming. When they stop buying in a particular market, I say, okay, so obviously that market got too expensive relative to what the rents that could be collected were, or maybe regulatorily that market has gotten unfriendly. So I do pay some attention to what they're doing. And one of the things that has happened over the last 12 months is they have largely stopped buying properties.
Well, yes, they have, but that's a little misleading in and of itself. What we've really seen is a shift in the type of properties that they're bringing to market. So when this all started, when the institution started getting involved back in 2009, and remember, that was right after the housing market crashed. Mm-hmm. So there were all these distressed properties sitting out there, frankly, vacant and deteriorating. And local governments were actually pitching investors on coming into the market and buying these properties, taking them out of that inventory, and doing something with them. And they did.
They almost single-handedly saved a lot of C neighborhoods in this country by going in and buying those properties by the dozens and hundreds.
The housing market would have been much worse, much longer had they not jumped in. And that model made sense at the time. It doesn't make sense today in a market where inventory is tight. And investors don't become successful investors by overpaying for assets. So they're not going to compete with consumers who are candidly, in some cases, more willing to overpay for a property than they are just because they want a house to live in. So what the investors have done is shifted their focus from buying those one-off properties and competing with everybody who sees a property on the MLS. They're now working with builders and building ground-up rental communities, townhouses, single-family units. That honestly, if I were an institutional investor, I probably would have moved in that direction much sooner, mm-hmm. because it gives you much more price control over what assets you're bringing to market. It gives you a more consistent quality of product. It gives you better ideas on your maintenance costs. And it makes it a lot easier to manage 30, 40, 50, 100 units because they're all in one place. They're mm-hmm. not scattered all over a metro area. Mm-hmm. So, yes, they are actually, for the last 7 quarters, they've been selling more properties than they've been buying. So the timing of this announcement from the administration is kind of ironic. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean they're getting out of the rental space. It just means they're bringing different types of rental properties to market.
Sure. They're getting out of the existing single family home space instead of just the single family home space. Yes. I've been watching with much amusement on social media, as my investor friends have been saying, this is great. It's a long time. It's been coming a long time, because I guess they agree that these people who own less than 2% of all the rentals in the country are somehow driving up the price of housing and rentals, when clearly they could not possibly be, given what a small player they are. This idea that, I don't know, anybody controls enough of the market to be controlling the prices is silly, but I guess no government. Because these guys, of course, have been the whipping boys for local governments for many years now. I guess they can't say, no, actually, the reason house prices and rents went up is because we issued $1 trillion and the value of every dollar went down. That would be less politically popular.
Well, we had all sorts of fiscal and monetary policy that contributed to this, beyond the fact that really from about 2008 until about 2019 or 2020, builders just underbuilt dramatically.
Sure.
Coming out of the house crash back in 2008, it made some sense because they were competing with their own inventory that was a year old that had been foreclosed on. It was now sitting on the market at half the price it had sold at a year before, and they just didn't want that excess inventory sitting on their books. But then they really never kicked back into gear for over a decade. And meanwhile, population grew by 78 million people. We had a lot of people reaching household formation age. They had nowhere to live. And most people still prefer to live indoors. So, you know, just casting a tent somewhere really wasn't an option. And so we had that underbuilding problem. And then COVID hit, and it was really a perfect storm. But when the Federal Reserve went to its zero interest rate policy and started just buying billions and billions of dollars of mortgage-backed securities in order to keep the economy from tanking, they obviously went a little bit too far. We had $15 trillion of stimulus pumped into the economy, which jacked up inflation, but to your point, also made all the dollars that were out there worth a little bit less. But we also had 2.5% mortgages, and that pulled a lot of demand forward. So now we had people who hadn't planned to buy a house for a couple of years suddenly in the market looking to buy, competing with other people for, you know, what was already a limited supply, and that just jacked prices up. We had prices go up 47% in about 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the whipsaw effect of the Fed coming in to try and get inflation under control that they had caused. And mortgage rates doubled in a matter of weeks. That had never happened in a year in the history of the United States. And in 2022, we saw mortgage rates double literally in a matter of weeks. So from an affordability perspective, we went from home prices are going up, but I can afford them because mortgage rates are 2%, to, geez, I can't afford anything right now.
And I can't afford to move. If I need to leave because my family shrunk, my family grew, whatever, I can't sell my house because I can't go from the 2.5% rate I have to a 6% rate, even on a smaller house, because I can't afford the payment.
You can't. And if people thought it was psychological, it was economical. People literally couldn't afford to do that, which shrunk the supply. And guess what? That made prices go up further. So mm-hmm. It's a whole host of reasons that we've landed in this affordability crisis for housing. The unfortunate reality that most people don't want to hear is the real solution to this is just time. It takes time. But finally, as we're getting into 2026, we're starting to see home price appreciation slow down pretty dramatically across the country. We're seeing wage growth continue to be pretty strong. And we're seeing mortgage rates start to tick down a little bit. So if all three of those continue to move in the right direction, you know, gradually affordability gets better. But there really are no quick fixes available right now. And slaying the Wall Street hedge fund dragon really isn't one that's going to make any difference.
Excellent. Rick, we're going to take a quick break. I want to remind listeners that we have a way that you can call up and ask Rick questions. You can just give us a Call at 877-772-9658. You can also send an email to vinaradio@gmail.com. And if you'd like to send a text instead, I'm still so tickled that we have a text line. The text line is 513-201-8249. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones Cox, talking today to Rick Sharga of CJ Patrick and Company about just numbers. He's a numbers guy. The rest of us just sort of live in the market and we have our impressions of what's going on. And of course, our impressions might depend a little bit on which market we're living in and also what particular strategy we're living in. But Rick goes around looking at numbers all day, every day, and can tell us what a little bit more about what is actually happening out in the world. So, Rick, high level, we're all still sitting around trying to make plans for 2026 after a very strange 2025 for many of us. And as you know, our listeners here are like, we're like independent real estate investors. We're not private equity. We're not Wall Street. We're people who, like, you know, we might own under 20 properties, or we might rehab 5, 6, 10 deals a year and resell them. What do you think the 2026 market looks like for us as compared to 2025?
Yeah, great question. We were talking before the break about some of the things that led to today's current market situation. And when 2022 hit, when mortgage rates went up, and you looked at affordability, I thought there were two potential things that could happen. We could either have a home price crash, which is what everybody on YouTube seems to be talking about still, or the more likely scenario is that the market was going to take 3 to 5 years to kind of reset at these new higher prices and higher mortgage rates before things settled down and felt normal again. And we've seen that in periods of history before where we've had some sort of economic shock in the housing market. 2025 felt to me like we were either in year 3 or maybe early year 4 of that reset period. And I believe we're starting to see signs that the market will start to finally recover in 2026. I think what we saw in 2024 and again in 2025 is what the baseline is for home sales in the country. We wound up with about 4 million existing home sales both years. And I think that's given the size of our population and the size of our economy, I think that's probably your minimum number of existing home sales that you're likely to see in a given year. It's the number of people who feel like they have to move. They got married, they got divorced, they had a kid, there was a death in the family, there's a new job, there's a loss of a job, some catalytic event that causes them to move. I think we're going to close 2025 when the final numbers come in, probably somewhere between 4.1 and 4.2 million homes sold. I think when we look at 2026, maybe that number goes up to 4.3, 4.4 million. But it does feel like it's starting to recover and move in the right direction. So long-winded answer, Vina, is I think we're looking at 2026 as being the first year of what will feel like a housing market recovery, and it'll probably get better as the year goes on. So I don't expect, again, a quick fix to the market, but I think things will improve as we get through the year.
So define recover, because I think that means different things if you're a seller trying to sell a property, or if you're a buyer trying to, like, get a decent price on a property, or if you're an investor trying to rent a property. Like, what when you say you think that you're going to look at this as the first year of the recovery, what does recovery mean?
Yeah, I'm talking mostly about sales volume there, Vina. So we went from about 6 million sales in 2021 to about 5 million in 2022. And then 23, 24, and 25, we sold about 4 million properties. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the headwinds that have kept those numbers from going up have been affordability related. So I think affordability will gradually improve this year, not for everybody and not for every market, but you know, for some markets and for some people. And we'll start to move back toward what I think really is a level of activity we should be seeing, which is closer to that 5 million a year annual sales. I think home prices will settle down dramatically. You're in a part of the country, excuse me, the Midwest, where prices have still been going up a little bit faster than the national averages, but nationally, we're probably looking at home prices this year going up probably between 1 and 1.5%, and certainly no more than 2%. And that'll vary market to market. Obviously, the Midwest and Northeast, where there's not quite as much inventory available, you're still seeing prices go up a little bit more. But that's what I mean by recovering. I think prices had to settle down. You're going to have price corrections in some markets, but volume of sales starts to pick up as more buyers come to market because now they can afford something.
Yes, and maybe more sellers start to realize that they can't get for their house what they could have gotten in early 2022. Because the thing that I saw last year that was, I've never seen this before. I've been in real estate for 35 years. I've been through a couple of these kind of recessionary market pullback kind of things. The number of delistings that happened in 2025. I read one stat that in several places, 45% of the properties that went up on the market for sale did not sell and got pulled off the market. So they're not still sitting there looking like extra inventory, but the sellers just basically said, hey, if I can't get my price that I want, I'll just stay where I am. And that's very unusual.
It is, but we're again coming out of a very unusual cycle. And that's the other reason, by the way, that I've been telling people for years now that they shouldn't be expecting a home price crash. In 2008, that same homeowner who listed a property and wasn't getting an offer had to sell the property because their mortgage rate had gone from a teaser rate of zero to market rate, which was 6%. And they couldn't afford to make the payments, and they were going to lose the house to foreclosure anyway. Or 30% of homeowners were underwater on their loans. They had to sell. In today's market, you're looking at $37 trillion of homeowner equity. You're looking at 40% of homeowners own a home mortgage-free. They don't have to sell. And if they don't get a price that they like, they're not going to bother. They're mm-hmm. going to pull the property back off the market and wait for market conditions to improve. So it's a very different market dynamic than what we saw, you know, in the last major cycle. And I think it's just reflective of today's reality in terms of supply and demand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, very true. Now, of course, in our world and in small real estate investor world, those retail sellers who are like, yeah, I'll put it out on the market, and if somebody gives me my price, I'll take it. And if not, I'm not even going to wait for a full six-month cycle. You know, if I don't get my price in 2 months, I'm pulling it off the market, and you'll see me again next year, right? Those are not our sellers. Those are not the people that we are typically working with. The people we're working with are the ones who do have to sell. They inherited the house. They're in foreclosure. They can't pay their taxes. We're having a big problem in this part of the country, and also, of course, in the Gulf region, with either taxes or insurance going up so much that people are being pushed out of their houses by the fact that they can't pay their real estate taxes or they can't afford to insure their houses. So those are the kinds of people that we are able to, like, you know, help them, like, solve their problem, get their property sold quick, and so on. And, you know, all the retail buyers who want to get full price, they can get full price. It's just, those aren't our people.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's been so tough for investors over the last couple of years is there haven't been a lot of distressed sales. Foreclosure activity in a normal year runs at about 1% of all mortgage holders are in foreclosure at some point or another during the course of a year. Right now, that number is about 0.5%. Mm-hmm. So it's way lower than normal. And a lot of those people still have equity. So rather than wait for the foreclosure auction and sell the property, have the property sold there, they're selling it earlier in the cycle. So I've been counseling investors, you know, find those people that are early in the foreclosure process and reach out to them directly, because there's probably a negotiated price between, you know, what their full market value would be and what they owe on the loan, mm-hmm. that everybody can be happy with and walk away with. But it's been a tough market just because of foreclosure activity, bank repossessions and those kind of properties, those REO assets that are typically marketed, have been so few and far between. We are seeing some of the kind of distress that you talked about in places you wouldn't necessarily expect. Obviously, Florida and Louisiana and Texas have had insurance rates that have doubled and tripled year over year. But Colorado, Oklahoma, other parts of the country that you just wouldn't be thinking about as being insurance problems are seeing the same sort of things happening. And, you know, when borrowers had to stretch to be able to afford to get into a house in the first place, you know, suddenly finding out that their insurance bill is going up by $300 a month can be enough to make or break them from a perspective of home ownership. So,
absolutely.
But the flip side of that is, if you're an investor buying that property, you have to either factor that into your holding costs as a rental property owner, or you have to realize that the next buyer of that property, if you're going to flip it, has to factor in those higher insurance costs and may not be able to afford the price that that house went for the last time, because their mortgage is going to be more expensive. So there's a lot of factors to consider that go into these things.
Very good. Rick, we need to take another break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Russell, who's been patiently waiting on the phone from Connecticut, and answer some questions that have come in via our email box, which is vinaradio@gmail.com. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones Cox. My guest today is Rick Sharga. It's the beginning of the year, so we're talking about, like, what's going to happen this year? What should we be thinking about as we are figuring out what we are going to do? And, of course, nobody has a crystal ball, but Rick does have a history book. He watches the numbers. He knows what these numbers have meant in prior cycles. So that's why we listen to him. And if you have any questions, you can give us a call at 877-772-9658. You can send us an email at vinaradio@gmail.com, or you can send a text to our text line at 513-201-8249. Let's go to line one and talk to Russell in Connecticut. Russell, welcome to Real Life Real Estate.
Yes, how are you doing? Great to see. Yeah, great points. I wanted to. You partially answered my question, although imagine 37 trillion of in deficit up there, size of our national debt. Anyway, so my question is more specific. What would it take to kind of to get the building? Or do you anticipate much home construction or rehab picking up this year or next year?
I can tell you what the builders have said about why they didn't pick back up on the whole building thing after the market recovered in this part of the country is about 2010, 2011. They said that they couldn't produce the amount of housing they wanted to because of the amount of fees, taxes, permitting costs, and development costs the cities had suddenly put on them, and simultaneously that the process was taking so long. So mm-hmm. you know, I used to be able to get clear to build in 3 months, and now it takes me a year and a half in a lot of areas. That in combination with a lot of the banking regulation changes, they were no longer like it doesn't work for them to finance the building of a property that they needed to finance at the beginning so they could buy the land, but it was going to take them a year and a half to break ground.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they said. Now, Rick, maybe you have some insight into what was really going on. Like, why are we generally builders want to build because that's how they make money, but they haven't been.
Yeah, and you just outlined a lot of the reasons why. One, to get to Russell's point, I think one of the things the administration is supposedly meeting this week to talk about things they can do to improve housing affordability. And Russell, you know that one of the things that we really need is more supply. And in markets across the country where we have a lot of inventory, we're actually seeing prices come down because it becomes more of a buyer's leverage kind of opportunity. The government could do a few things. It could make certain government lands available for building, which would get through a lot of the permitting and regulatory stuff that Vina was talking about. They could also work with local and state governments and these builders to do sort of a public-private partnership where they'll financially incent builders to create properties in certain areas and certain types of properties, like entry-level properties. Fannie Mae did some research a few years ago where they determined that the average cost a builder had to go through before they broke ground on a property was about $80,000. And in states like California, it was closer to $100,000. That's before they broke ground. So to build affordable housing almost anywhere becomes really challenging if those are your table stakes. Mm-hmm. So whatever we can do to reduce regulatory constraints and get some of those early fees down will help.
Yep.
Okay.
Fees and timelines. The thing that here in the city in which I live, it's mostly small builders building within the city limits because you can't buy an acre of land inside the city limits and build a whole subdivision. So it's mostly builders who are building in onesies and twosies, which is good. Like, we need infill housing in the cities. People want to live in the cities. But the thing that they mostly complain about is the red tape and the amount of time that it takes to get something started and built and the inspection processes and how long that takes. And the ones who've been in it for 25 years say it used to be a lot faster.
Yep.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like that's something that's going to happen. You didn't see that. I guess no one really knows for sure, although I guess I think that's going to make that might a little bit easier.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, and you live in a part of the country where the regulations are even worse.
Yeah.
You live in a part of the country where it is just famously difficult to get anything done. So.
Yeah.
Well, the other reality is builders are building where people are moving, and so you don't see the kind of massive migration numbers we saw right out of COVID. Where people were kind of fleeing from the high-priced coastal areas into parts of the middle of the country. Boise, Idaho was a hotbed for some reason. But we do see population moving out of the Northeast into the southeastern parts of the country, into the Midwest. And the southern part of the country is where we see more builder activity than other parts of the country.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
All right. Thank you for your call, Russell.
You're welcome.
Appreciate you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Rick, my Facebook page is filling up with people saying, no, this is a good thing that they're going to stop these hedge funds from owning all of these properties. And this is real estate investors saying this. And I just want to say to you guys, you got to either be principled about private property rights and capitalism, or you have to say, no, I only, only for me, not for thee. You can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, I don't like these big companies competing against me, as if they really compete against you anyway. When was the last time you were like up against a private equity fund trying to buy the same property? And I'd also like to remind you that, about incrementalism. And that right now it might mean anyone who owns more than 1,000 properties, and then it might be 500, and then it might be 200, and then at some point it might get to 25, which is the number that most of us agree we need to have 25 paid off rentals to retire. What are you going to do when they come after you? Either.
Well, just to put a point on that, Vina, there was a bill in Congress during the last year of the Biden administration that was aimed at quote unquote institutional investors as well. And the limit on the number of properties there was 50.
Yeah, I saw that.
And that's hardly what most of us would call a big institutional investor. So 50 is not a big jump to 25, mm-hmm. and 25 is not a big jump to 10. Mm-hmm. And then before you know it, there's questions about why anybody should be able to own any rental properties.
Exactly.
And there are politicians beating their chest now saying that maybe Airbnb and Vrbo and other short-term rental properties shouldn't be allowed. Okay. And so your point about private property rights is absolutely spot on and you know, should be at the forefront of people's minds, especially with what's going on in New York City right now. Mm-hmm. So investors really need to be thinking about, you know, which, as I said earlier, which dragon they choose to slay.
Yes, yes. I am not in love with any of the Wall Street owners. I know one particular one here in Cincinnati has just been taking it on the chin for years to the point, every mayor, every county commissioner has kind of made them into a punching bag about, you know, they don't maintain their properties and they don't treat their tenants right. And, you know, I read that stuff in the paper. I don't necessarily believe everything I read in the paper. Maybe it's true, but it's not because they are a Wall Street company. Like there are slumlords who are not Wall Street companies and there are Wall Street companies that are not slumlords. Let's separate those things and not say they're just evil for, I don't know, finding a business opportunity and taking advantage of it, because you're next. You're the next one who's going to be evil for finding a business opportunity and taking advantage of it. Rick, we need to take one more quick break. When we come back, we will wrap up our conversation on the statistics for 2026. Listeners, at this point, you probably should send an email if you have any questions for Rick. VinaRadio@gmail.com. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones Cox. My guest today is Rick Sharga, and I'm glad that Bob is thinking of this as fun. Like, he's sitting here with the popcorn going, yeah, listen to them, man. They're like talking about capitalism and freedom and private property and,
listen,
you know.
Listen, drink it in.
I think, yeah. Well, I think Rick and I are actually a little annoyed by what's going on, because it's, you know, maybe some infringement up on those things, as opposed to, you know, what we want to see, which is a market that is fair to all. Rick, I sent you a set of questions and, you know, we were like, oh, we're not going to get through all of these. We've gotten through, like, I don't know, three of them. So let's kind of try to hit on the things that are really going to affect our listeners who are, you know, smaller rental housing providers. They do have Airbnbs. They do have little apartment buildings. They are rehabbers who resell. The thing that we really have not touched upon is the bigger economic factors that kind of steer the real estate market along with the rest of the market. So inflation, wage growth, consumer debt, what do you see happening in 2026 in those areas?
Wow. If I knew the answers to all those, I'd be doing this by satellite from my private island in the Caribbean. It's been perplexing this year, as you know. The economy has actually outperformed expectations, and we're looking at, you know, about 4% GDP growth in the third quarter, and forecasts for the fourth quarter numbers when they come in are much stronger than most economists had forecast. And those same economists are basically looking at 2026 and saying, well, it'll be slower growth this year. So you don't know if they're going to be right this time. But that seems to be the general consensus, is maybe the economy will grow at around a 2% clip for the total year. We didn't have the kind of huge impact on inflation from tariffs that had been predicted, partly, I guess, because some of the tariffs weren't implemented, but partly because we just haven't seen the pass-through effect on the economy that we thought we might see. And usually if you do have an inflationary impact from tariffs, it's pretty early in the cycle, so we may have dodged that bullet. In fact, the last inflation numbers came in at, I believe, 2.6 or 2.7% year over year, which was again, lower than the economists had forecasted. So I'm cautiously optimistic about the overall economy next year. My one area of concern is, candidly, the jobs market. We've seen unemployment tick up to about 4.6%. Partly that's because we're seeing more people returning to the workforce, and that usually does inflate unemployment numbers temporarily while those folks are looking for work. And long-term unemployment hasn't ticked up along with those shorter-term numbers. We've seen less hiring. We're not seeing a ton of jobs open that need to be filled. And so it's almost like, but we're also not seeing a ton of firings. The biggest layoffs we've really seen last year are federal government jobs that have been eliminated. So there's a lot of kind of fuzz in the numbers that we're looking at that get reported. But I would not be terribly surprised to see the economy grow, but a little bit more slowly, to see inflation continue to kind of gradually work its way down from where we were a couple of years ago, and for the jobs market to be kind of lackluster, if you will, in 2026, slightly higher unemployment and not tremendous job growth until the market has a little bit more certainty about, you know, which kind of economic policies we're really going to follow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. To some extent, the real estate market is a self-fulfilling prophecy. The reality is that people don't feel good about, am I still going to have a job in 6 months? Or they don't feel good about, is this a good time for me to move up into a more expensive rental or buy myself a house? Then that, I mean, we see that impact. Like, that's not.
Oh, yeah. The consumer sentiment is another number you follow, and if people aren't sure about their jobs, if they're still having trouble making ends meet, those consumer sentiment numbers tend to be pretty weak, and if they're weak, that means people aren't going to be really anxious to make long-term huge financial commitments. So it does have an impact on housing. There's no question about that. I think the affordability issues that we've seen over the last couple of years have made it more difficult for fix and flip investors to make the kind of margins they need, because, you know, you're not sure at what price point you should be buying, if you can add enough value to the house to get the price you need to make your margins when you sell it. We've seen the cost of labor go up significantly over the last couple of years. Materials costs, interestingly, haven't gone up that much in the last year or two, despite the tariff concerns.
Well, that's okay, because they doubled or tripled in 2020 and 2021, so we're still...
They did, and they're still going up, but everybody expected it to be a lot worse than it actually was. I guess it's kind of like going to the dentist, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've seen because of the affordability is much more opportunity for rental property investors. We had something like 5 million young adults reach the age of 35 last year. That's typically an age where they either have or should be forming their own households. A lot of them historically have been buying homes at that point, but they haven't been able to afford to in this cycle. So some research I recently did with another company, almost a third of the people that said they were typically flippers have shifted at least temporarily into buying properties, fixing them up, and holding them as rentals.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just waiting for market dynamics to improve a little bit before they ultimately sell off those properties. But I suspect we have a lot of inadvertent rental property owners right now.
Yes. So I know some of them, and I'm glad you said that, because one of the things that we're trying to teach people right now is always have a plan B.
Yeah,
because a lot of the, you know, as you know, flippers are often borrowing money from hard money lenders, and it's costing them a percent a month or more, plus the taxes, plus the insurance, plus the utilities to hold on to them. And this thing about, well, no, but I'm supposed to put it on the market. It's supposed to sell in 2 weeks at higher than asking price. That was a few years ago. That wasn't 2025, and it's probably not going to be 2026. And so having that plan B of how do I get some permanent financing or get a partner who can take out that hard money loan, rent it for a while, is a classic plan B. I mean, people have always done that. So that's always what has happened when your rehab wasn't selling quickly enough, but Also, that has some tax advantages, rehabbers. If you hold the property for a year before you sell it, you actually pay less tax.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of advantages, but I think you're, you know, when we're dealing with people just starting out in the business, they often don't quite have that level of sophistication, unless they're listening to your show, of course. But they really do need to be thinking through those options. And I tell investors all the time, you know, what do you look for in a market? Well, I look for three things. I look for population growth, I look for job growth, and I look for wage growth. And if you have those three things happening in a market, you're likely to have good real estate opportunities, whether it's to sell an owner-occupied property or it's to rent out a property to somebody that can afford to pay you that rent. Mm-hmm. And for what it's worth, the rental asking prices on single-family homes have been much more stable over the last year than the asking rents on apartment units. We've actually nationally seen apartment asking rents flatten and go negative over the course of 2025, whereas from a single-family residential property perspective, those asking rents have come down as low as 2% year over year, but they've still been positive. So, you know, if you have that home and it doesn't look like selling it in a reasonable period of time is an option, you really ought to be looking at renting as a backup plan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you folks who want to buy apartments, you should be listening to that part about nationally apartment rents are down because apartments are valued based on how much rent they collect every year and how much expenses they pay every year. And there's a lot of the apartment folks are saying that there's going to be some super good opportunities like we have not seen before in 2026 in apartments because of defaults, because of people who are coming to the end of their five-year bridge loan and can't actually refinance their property. So lots of good stuff hidden here in this data, Rick, if we know how to look for it. And, of course, these lulls in the market where stuff's not going up super fast, where there aren't there's not actually a ton of competition in the market right now. I mean, like, yes, there's still other investors out looking, but there's not nearly what we saw in 2021 and 2022. These are often good times to pick up some bargain properties from people who really need to sell, and there just aren't as many buyers out there. And want to encourage folks to keep their eyes open for those things in 2026. Rick, very much appreciate you. We are unfortunately out of time. I think I want to touch base with you mid-year this time instead of waiting an entire year to talk again, because you always help us understand what's going on and why we are seeing the things we are seeing. So thank you very much for being here with us today.
Always a pleasure, and be happy to do it again mid-year.
Excellent. Thank you, Rick. You've been listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing. We will be back next week with more information to put you on the path to financial independence through real estate investing. Until then, happy investing.